Wilson's picture of renormalization and the form of the exact RG equation. So in this lecture, I'll talk about derivative expansion, which is an approximation scheme you can use when there's no small parameters available, at least in scalar field theory. So again, it's just a brief review of the literature. Again, by no means comprehensive, but some of the papers I like. So it's the usual suspects here. So there's the review by Tim Morris, which this has actually got some extremely deep stuff in it. I'd highly recommend this one. There's the review by Banyuls and Bavillier, and the one by Vetterich. And here is a list of some of the original literature, not all of it. This paper by Hasenfratz and Hasenfratz is a really beautiful piece of work in particular. And there's many different ways of deriving the derivative expansion. I'll be using their methodology. I think it's particularly elegant.
These are the guys where isn't the guy who introduces perfect action?
Yeah, yeah. That, yes, I think that was Peter Hasenfratz.
And maybe at some point it would be nice to talk about that, because in 3D, the way we quantize 3D gravity, yeah, is that, I think, you know, one way to formulate that is that we know exactly the perfect action.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well.
But it's not usually the way it's presented.
By all means, yeah. So here's a summary of the...
What is the perfect action?
Well, the perfect action is, in fact, an action that's on the renormalized trajectory. So any action that's on this trajectory coming out of the fixed point is a perfect action. The same thing. But a renormalizable action that would be free of lattice artifacts in a lattice formulation.
But it's also, it's also the action which is somehow invariant. So you know,
this. And because it's from the trajectory, it's invariant in all.
Yes. So the Poisson function is just invariant there. And in 3D, usually you put your theory in lattice, and there's an infinite number of ways of doing that, and then people try to plug it. But in 3D, we know if we take the Ponzano-Leger model, the guy is just in, the partial function is invariant. So it's just sitting, it's deeper.
Right, okay, yeah.
Which is there. And but of course, it would be nice to show that every other way of discretizing is flow to this one.
So these are some of the concepts from the earlier lectures that we'll require. So this one was that to see fixed point behavior, which is what fixed point behavior in the flows out of them, we need to rescale to dimensionless units. And along the renormalized trajectories, we have this self-similar form. And this will be extremely important when interpreting some of the results of the derivative expansion. So I also mentioned that there are two common forms of the ERG. There's the Wilsonian, the one that involves the Wilsonian effective action. This is Polchinski-like. And there's the effective average action. This was the formalism introduced by Vetterich. And both of them have their advantages and disadvantages. This one has actually got some very nice features with regards to the derivative expansion. I'll kind of be switching between the two pictures when it's useful for me to do so. So when we linearized about a fixed point, we defined the scaling operators. So these were the relevant, the marginal, and the irrelevant operators. And I mentioned in the first lecture that there were these redundant operators, which were unphysical. These are related to invariances of the exact RG, and I'll actually talk about these in a little bit more detail later today. So here's an outline of the lecture. So I'm going to start just with a sort of a preamble before talking about the motivation for the derivative expansion. Then at lowest order, the derivative expansion is called the local potential approximation. I'll discuss this in some detail, so how to set it up and how to find fixed points, how to examine the properties of the fixed points. And then I'll briefly go beyond leading order. And it's when I talk about reparameterization invariants that the redundant operators will come into play. So the starting point, I'm going to use this flow equation. So if you recall from the last lecture, this was a cousin of the Polchinski equation where I'd done this rescaling to include the anomalous dimension, and it effectively amounted to including the anomalous dimension or including the rescaling on the left-hand side, but not on the right-hand side. And this just was using a different blocking functional in my setup. So this is the starting equation that I'll use. And just to remind, so these are the exact RG kernels which incorporate the ultraviolet regularization. This sigma has a bit that's linear in S, so the equation as a whole is nonlinear as required. And then there's this extra bit, this S hat, where S hat is the so-called seed action. And the simplest choice, you can just take it to have a regularized kinetic term. And if I make this choice for the integrated kernel, then this would just be essentially Polchinski's equation modulo the fact that I've incorporated the anomalous dimension explicitly in this fashion.
How do you compute the anomalous dimension?
So the anomalous dimension is determined by renormalization condition, and something we can see later in the talk.
And I mean, to give a feeling on this equation, a better feeling, you can use maybe more language.
So a bit more out.
Well, why there's a sum of two terms when it's...
I did cover this in the last lecture. So I haven't really got time to go into this again now, unless it's extremely important that I do so. I mean, are people happy enough with this equation for me to just use it by now?
Okay. So
just a little bit on the notation that I'll use. So I can define the vertices of the Wilsonian effective action as follows. So here I've got an n-point vertex with my n fields. I've got the integrals over momenta. So I've got my momentum-conserving delta function, and this is the vertex coefficient function here. So the n is just to tell me that I've got n fields, and here are the momentum arguments. And this is often written, this integral here, just as integral over p. And if one puts a hat on the delta, there's just a 2 pi to the d that's been included. So the first step that I want to do to as preparation for finding this fixed-point behavior is to rescale to dimensionless variables. And so I've already rescaled using the root of z. This was the thing that took the anomalous dimension into the equation. So I've got to now scale out the naive or classical or engineering dimensions. So the dimensionality of phi just follows by normal analysis. So in d dimensions, it's d minus 2 over 2. And if I do the Fourier transform, you can see that phi of p has this dimensionality here. I've got an extra d coming from this thing. So what I want to do then is, because I'm working in momentum space, is I'm going to rescale phi as follows. And so my flow equation, the left-hand side of the flow equation, transforms as follows. So because I've made this change here, when lambda d lambda hits this, I'm going to pick up this extra factor here of d plus 2 over 2. So that's the field now that's being completely rescaled. So the other thing to rescale is momenta. So I just shift p goes to p lambda. And here are my vertices, and it has three effects which cause the left-hand side of the equation to change as follows. So I'll just go through what they are. So you can see that this term here is compensating for the rescaling in the integrals. So the measure for each of these integrals is going to pick up a factor of lambda to the d, hence the d here when it gets hit by that. And this phi dot d phi just counts the number of fields. So for each field, there's one integral. For each integral, I pick up d, so I need to put this factor in here. This component here, d, this just comes from rescaling the momentum with inside the delta function. And this complicated-looking expression is arising from differentiating these with respect to lambda at constant dimensionless p rather than p. So when I put everything together, it will become clear what each of these bits are. And this prime just means that it doesn't strike the delta function. So it looks a bit messy, but there's a simple interpretation, which I'll show here. So this prime, it's not striking the delta function. I've already taken account of the change in the delta function here.
So this guy, the term phi p delta phi p, so you count each field, and then for each field you apply this rescaling.
Yeah, so what it's essentially doing is, if I've got some vertex coefficient function, I want to count the number of powers of momentum. So what this operator is doing is the momentum scale counting operator, if you like. Because I'm rescaling everything, I need to keep track of things that I've rescaled. So if I've got a momentum p that I then shifted to p over lambda, or rather p lambda, I need to count that. And so this is just counting the number of derivatives which each vertex has.
Which is also counting the number of fields.
Right, so what you want to do is, this one here, this thing will, you know, it could act on this field first, and then it will count, then this operator, this pdp, will count the number of p1s in the vertex. Then you move along, it will count the number of p2s in the vertex. You move along, it will count the number of p3s, and count the number of pn. So the net effect is it counts the total number of p's that occur in the vertex. So there's a more instructive way of writing this, which I will show on the next transparency. So just before I do that, I want to... Oops, sorry. Just finish the rescaling. So minus lambda d lambda is written usually as dt, with t equal log mu over lambda, where mu is just some scale. And so t is this RG time, which is starting let's say, at a fixed point at minus infinity and flowing to plus infinity in the infrared. I can also rewrite delta dot here. So delta dot was just minus lambda d lambda of this regularized propagator. So I can just do this, do the lambda d lambda, and the p squared disappears, gets replaced with a lambda squared, and I get this c primed. So when I put everything together, it should become a bit clearer why the flow equation takes the form that it does. So the left-hand side has become quite simple now. And what I've got here is this is the full dimension of the field in position space, and this is the field counting operator. So the effect of the rescaling, the first thing I want to do, because I've rescaled the field, I want to count up all the changes that occurred for each of the fields. So hence, I count the number of fields and multiply by the full dimension of the field. And this thing is the momentum scale counting operator. So again, I've made these changes to the momentum. I'm now measuring the units of lambda, so I need to just count up all the powers of momentum. And that's what this thing does. And then this was just associated with the delta function. So this is the form of the equation that I'll use.
This looks very much like a Hamilton-Jacobi equation.
Pass. I don't know.
Yeah, you've got a DT, yes.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, have you, yeah, I guess it's, maybe it's a sort of joke, but you know, this idea that moving radially in a DS space is like a linear organization. And, you know, in some sense, yeah. I mean, here you wrote down the equation, but people have really, you know, kind of dig into this equation, try to give it any study, see some analogy. Because it really looks like behind that there's a Hamilton-Jacobi system or a Hamiltonian system or this. It looks really like. Suppose you take a Hamiltonian equation and then you say, well, let me split my stuff into S plus sigma and then, you know, and then take S as my generator of time evolution. Then you get something very similar to that.
It almost looks more like a Schringer nice because there are these kind of terms on the right hand side. Right?
Well, the exact RG equation is, yeah, it's related to Schwinger-Dyson equations. And certainly, you know, the diagrammatic expansions I was talking about last week are very similar. I mean, in the Schwinger-Dyson equations, you get bare vertices appearing as well. You only ever get renormalized vertices here, but there are some distinct similarities.
Well, except the right-hand side looks like delta S, delta sigma. This is like the other guy looks like exactly a kinetic term, you know, regularized kinetic term.
In short, I don't know if there's a map between the two. But anyhow, so this is the equation that I'll be using, this rescaled form.
So you're using a particular form of delta dot?
Yes, I've been using delta, or so the dot just means minus lambda d lambda, and delta itself I've been taking as this ultraviolet regularized propagator. So a motivation for the derivative expansion, well, the exact RG equation, the ERGE, it's an integral differential equation, contains variational derivatives, it's non-linear, and it's also applied to problems where there's no small parameter. So this is a difficult equation to deal with. And not surprisingly, exact solutions of the equation are only known in very special cases. So for example, if you're looking for Gaussian solutions, you can find those. So if you're looking for more general solutions and you've got no small parameter, what you want is a reliable truncation scheme. Now, for finding non-trivial fixed points, if you just expand in powers of the field and truncate the infinite series that you get from this, it's known that this is unreliable, and this was demonstrated in one of Morris's earlier papers. So given that this doesn't work, what else can you do? Well, you can try expanding in derivatives of the field. So what I've got here is, this is my local potential. This depends just on phi and not its derivatives. This part here, when k lambda of phi has no phi dependence, this is the kinetic term, and then you're just building up all terms which have a d mu phi squared, and then you've got order d to the 4.
Can you say it's unreliable? What do you mean?
So you actually find spurious fixed points with this. So the truncation doesn't converge.
Find this first fixed point, then you can increase at each. Suppose you do polynomial extension. Do they disappear or do they stay for a while?
Well, I think they, this is the point, they appear at some point.
They appear and they disappear?
I don't think they disappear. I don't know. You'd have to look it up. But certainly the truncation doesn't converge. So as you include more terms, you just get this wild oscillatory behavior.
So yeah, it's because that's the claim of Reuter, right? Doing the truncation and finding exponents. So, but at least
yeah.
So the question is, in that case, what happens when you increase the number?
Oh, sure, yeah. Well, it's something that he needs to address. I mean, as you said, that you know, Pacacci has done some work where he includes what is it, 7 invariants, and it seems to work. But sure, it's a question that you need to seriously worry about whether your truncation scheme actually converges or not.
And in that case, what exactly happens? So first, there's no
I'd have to look up when exactly they appear in the truncation scheme. But it certainly gives spurious fixed points. So yeah, that's a kind of a lesson for any truncation scheme. That you need to be very careful that what you're finding is really isn't a truncation artifact. So here's a justification for the derivative expansion. So you're essentially throwing away derivatives. And the hope is that it captures the essentials of the long-distance physics. Now, something which has just occurred to me, but I've never seen mentioned. Now, of course, fixed points themselves are actually scale independent, so I'm not quite sure what it means to want to capture the essence of the long-distance physics in this case. I think maybe the justification is that in statistical physics, you're going from some critical model whose infrared behavior is controlled by a fixed point, so maybe that's the justification. But I've always wondered how this justification fits in with that, but it's just an observation. But irrespective of these points, one sees that even at lowest order, where you've got this local potential, you've got an infinite number of interactions which are included. So this, at least, this is a good thing. And perhaps even more importantly, it actually works in practice, and moreover, is proven reliable. So you can find fixed points with it, and you can compute critical exponents to good accuracy. So I'll now talk about the first order approximation. So this is the local potential approximation. So as I mentioned a moment ago, this is the ansatz you take for the action. So you keep a kinetic term here, and then you just take these non-derivative interactions. But V of phi is completely general. Now notice that because the kinetic term isn't renormalizing, the anomalous dimension is zero. So in the local potential approximation, you can see that the approximation scheme is only going to be sensible for finding fixed points if the anomalous dimension is suitably small, because it's automatically setting it to zero. So if I write the action in this form here, so this is just, again, just writing out expanding here to define my vertices, then what the approximation consists of taking is at the two-point level, I'm taking the two-point vertex to have a kinetic term here, the half p squared plus the momentum-independent bit, and for all other vertices, I'm just throwing away the momentum dependence entirely. So a brief history of the LPA. It was first written down by Nicol and Chang in 1974. It was then rediscovered certainly three times. I think there was a fourth, at least, completely independently. So it was the Hassenfratz and Hassenfratz. That was in 1984. Then, about 9 years later, Tim Morris and Christoph Wetterich discovered it. It seems completely independently of each other, without being aware of either this paper or that paper. And I think Elvanger also discovered it. So it kept on cropping up over a period of about 20 years independently. And every author has their own pet way of deriving the approximate flow equation. So you've got this projection of the action, and you need to project the flow equation as well. And everybody does it slightly differently. And also, there are several different versions of the LPA to start, depending on your starting point. So if you use a Polchinski-like flow equation, you'll get one version of the LPA. If you use the Wetterich-like equation, you get a different version of the LPA. But hopefully they produce the same physics.
So, how much of the same physics?
Well, So they do produce the same fixed point spectrum and the same spectrum of eigenvalues and so forth. So,
if you try to write down this perfect action explicitly in one case or the other,
I mean the actual fixed point action itself isn't a physical thing. I mean, this is it's a non-universal object, so I don't see that they coincide. But the important things with regards to the fixed point are whether or not it exists at all and what the eigenvalues are associated with it.
When you say it's a non-universal thing, it's great, but does it mean that at least they should be related by field transformation? You have two such.
Well, yes, okay. Sure, okay, so if you're doing it, I mean, so Vetteri's equation and Bolchinski's equation, there's a Legendre transform relationship between them. So I'd expect that there's some similar relationship between the solutions as well. So this is the Hassenfratz projection method, which I think is particularly elegant. And you just introduce this projector here, P of x. So what it does acting on G is you take these derivatives, d by d phi, at zero field, at zero momentum, and you replace the phi with just this variable x. So this is projecting out the momentum-dependent pieces. A nice feature of it is if it acts on this string of operators, g1 to gm, you can just replace this by p of x acting first on g1, then a different one acting on p2, and a different one acting on g3, and so forth. So the effect on the action here is that it replaces the arguments of all the vertex coefficient functions just with zero. Because, of course, we were taking d by d phi at zero momentum, so all these arguments get set to zero. And this is precisely just what we mean by the local potential phi of x. So in other words, the potential where there's no momentum dependence. Now notice that I get this delta of zero left over, which isn't well defined. So this is, of course, this conserved all momenta. I set all momenta to zero, so I just get delta of zero. And there's various things you can do with this. So you can regularize it by working in a finite box, and that's what Hassenfratz and Hassenfratz did. You can remove it through a rescaling of the field. And I'm not going to really do either of these. I'm just going to treat it somewhat implicitly, so it will appear in some of my formulas and then magically disappear. But it's consistent. You can choose one of these two methods to do so. Well, so what you're trying to do is you're trying to pick out a single mode in a continuum of modes, and that's why it appears. There's both of these two methods that have exactly the same effect. So let's actually project the flow equation. So start with the classical term. So let me just use the board for a second. So the classical term had this form. So it was a ds by d phi c primed ds by d phi, something of this form. And I said that the projector, if I'm acting on a string of things, I can just act on one and then act on the second one. So if I act on this guy here, then what it's going to do is, well, I've got a d by d phi, so that's going to get rid of the field that this is acting on. So the momentum is going to not be set to zero. But you can see that because all the others are set to zero, and because I've got conservation of momentum, this one, too, is going to become zero. And so this thing here is just the derivative of V, as one might expect. So when I take the full term here, I get a V prime from this bit, I get a V prime from this bit, and this guy just gets evaluated at zero momentum. And in the literature, this C prime of zero is often called minus K zero. So just to conform with that notation, I put that in there.
So C prime is the numerator of C over
T squared? So C is just my cutoff function. C prime is just the derivative with respect to its argument.
The cutoff function is again the numerator.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. But at leading order, as I'll show in a second, you can actually rescale K0 out of the equation. So you can make it manifestly independent of the details of the cutoff function at leading order. But not beyond. So the quantum term is a little bit different because now I've got this pair of derivatives. And so when I act with a projector, I've lost two of my fields, and so they retain the momentum arguments. So I've got this P minus P, which aren't set to zero by the projector. So this is where I use my approximation scheme. So again, let me just write this up on the board. So what I had was at the two-point level, I wrote this as a half p squared, as a half plus this guy, whereas for everything else, I just replace the momentum arguments with zero. So you can see that within my approximation scheme, what I want to do then is replace this with a half p squared plus v double primed. So the only momentum part that I've kept is at the two-point level. However, yes, so when I come to evaluate my quantum term here, what I end up with is just this V double primed, with the constant term, the constant contribution just being discarded. I'm never interested in the vacuum contributions here. So if I put everything together, this is the form of my flow equation. So this was the quantum term with this V double primed. This was the classical term, which has got the non-linearity, this V prime squared. And these are just the bits from rescaling the flow equation.
So back to the equation I have here, but also in the general equation, because it's true that this equation is from DTS plus a term which is linear in S plus a term which contains two derivatives. So it has the form of a Victor Jacobi plus quantum term. Right? There's a classical bit, and then there's a quantum bit.
Okay.
So suppose you drop the quantum bits and you look at the flow equation for the classical bit. What is the interpretation of this classical flow equation?
Well, so, I mean, what you'd be doing is, if you've integrated down to some effective scale, then the classical terms that you're generating are classical diagrams but built out of renormalized vertices. So everything's been renormalized down to the scale lambda. So it's not bare tree diagrams you're constructing, it's renormalized tree diagrams.
So is there a way to derive the classical Pochinsky equation, not doing the quantum case, but just looking at the classical theory and saying something about that? It's a classical equation, each bar does not answer.
So you want to just throw away the quantum part?
You know, to give a more intuitive feeling or understand. Suppose you look at this equation. There's no h-bar in this equation. So it's a purely classical procedure. But it means that it corresponds to something you do purely at the classical level. But it's hard to... Since there you don't have a passing integral or you don't integrate on a mode, what is it?
Well, as I said, I mean, it's a little bit more than that in the Polchinski equation, because although it is called the classical term, as I said, it nevertheless has already incorporated the effects of the quantum fluctuations down to, you know, between the bare scale and the effective scale. So it's a classical term for renormalized vertices. So it does include quantum effects nevertheless.
Well, I'm just saying the equation can be written without h-bar. So maybe it's not known, but it's begging for a classical interpretation. You say it's not known. It's like a Schrodinger equation. I mean, it is a Schrodinger equation. This equation, time dependent Schrodinger, d of dt s, or big exponential s. So there's a classical truncation. Okay, maybe. There's no interpretation of that.
So you mean no? You're looking for interpretation of the equation if you just drop the quantum term.
Usually, when you have a quantum equation, there's always, I mean, it's always somehow related to some quantization of some classical position. So, and sometimes it's enlightening to understand what is this classical position.
Well, I don't know off the top of my head. I mean, certainly, if you drop the quantum term, you know, the partition function would no longer be invariant under this procedure. So.
No, but maybe something else would be like the tree level.
I don't know.
Maybe not. Maybe the classical transition has no meaning, or it's a question.
I mean, I'd be rather wary of doing it, as I said, because you lose invariance of the partition function. So I don't think it would just be as simple as dropping
the
quantum term.
The invariance of the classical partition, the one where you send V to zero.
I don't know if. I certainly haven't seen it done, but maybe one could.
I mean, for the partition function, it might be complicated, but for the effective action, then. The effective action is like the Lipton Jacobi function, right? So at the classical level, so it should have.
Well, it's not obvious to me what interpretation would be of just dropping the quantum term, but. So this is the form of the equation where I've got these two functions, k0 and i0, which depend on the cutoff function. And one can actually just get rid of these by performing global rescalings. So if I rescale v in this way and x in this way, then it has the effect of just removing these two from the equations completely. So this is the equation. I've written this 2 minus d over 2 just as little d. And what I've got here is now a nonlinear partial differential equation. No longer has any functional derivatives. And it's also manifestly independent of the cutoff function. So this is now the starting point for trying to find fixed point solutions. So to do this, here's the setup. The fixed point solutions correspond to V dot, you know, the time derivative, the RG time derivative being zero. And so this is my fixed point equation with the star just reminding me that this is a fixed point that I'm looking at. So this is a second order differential equation, so I need two boundary conditions. So the first boundary condition I'm going to impose is that I've got an even potential. So I'm just going to take that V prime of zero is equal to zero. And the other boundary condition, I'm just going to choose some value for V of zero. And at this point, it looks like there's a paradox, because I seem to have a continuous one-parameter family of fixed points labeled by this solution here, labeled by this choice here. I've got a second-order differential equation. It seems like I've got this arbitrary choice of V star of zero.
Where do you think these boundary conditions?
This is one way of choosing boundary conditions. There's another way which will resolve this paradox, which I'll talk about in a second.
But what do they mean? Why do you choose
this choice? So this one, as I said, ensures that the potential is even. Mm-hmm. And now I need another boundary condition. So I'm just going to choose it to be this. Mm-hmm. So it's a choice I can make. Well, because it seems that I've got, instead, a continuous one-parameter set of fixed-point solutions. So usually you expect just a single fixed point or a couple of fixed points. You expect there's only a discrete set. You don't expect to have an infinite continuous family.
There are systems where, like, your critical lines, x, y, z, you know.
Well, this is certainly not what you expect here. I mean, this, you know, in three-dimensional scalar field theory, for example, you know where there's the Wilson-Fisher fixed point and the Gaussian fixed point. They're the critical ones. You certainly don't expect an infinite family of critical fixed points. Mm-hmm. And the solution to this is that all but a finite number of solutions encounter a singularity at a finite value of x. So here's the strategy. I'll outline this in some detail. So the procedure is, so you choose a value of V star of zero, and you now iterate the numerical routine, and what you find is at some point you hit a singularity. So record the value of the field at which this singularity occurs, and then make a plot of your initial boundary condition against the value at which you encounter a singularity. And so I'll show this on a plot here. So this is not data that I generated. This is a sketch of something from one of Tim Morris's paper. So you can see, suppose that I've started with some choice of the boundary condition here. And what I've done is I've iterated my equation, and then at some point I've hit a singularity, and so I record the value at which I reach the singularity there. And so I do this over a large range of parameters, and what I look for is I look for peaks like this, which go off up to infinity. So what this is telling me here is that the solution is globally defined, so at no finite value of xc, or rather at no finite value of the field, am I hitting a singularity. So it's defined for all values of the field. And this is in four dimensions, and you can see that the only solution to the equation which is defined globally is the Gaussian solution, the one for which the potential vanishes.
Mm-hmm. Can you go back to the equation to give a feeling of the... Because you're going very, very fast.
There's the...
So small d here is...
So d is just d minus 2 over 2.
And big d is...
D, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So this equation, you can write it as an Hamiltonian equation. Suppose I look for exponential minus v, and I call that psi.
Okay, right? Yeah.
So this equation is something like p square. You know, there's an Hamiltonian behind that. Right. So you're asking h equal to 0, where the Hamiltonian h is something like p square plus xp plus d.
Sorry, do you want to write it?
just to get a feeling of what this equation is.
So you want...
Because you're going very, you know, it's not just... To see what...
So you want to rewrite in terms of...
Of some Hamiltonian system.
So it's like a, you know, sort of... is this the thing you have in mind?
I'm looking, I'm interpreting your equation and saying dt of psi is equal to h. Of psi, and then there's an Hamiltonian, which is this randomization group Hamiltonian, which appears.
So you want dt. Right, so you want something of this form.
Yeah, and then you're looking for a vacuous state of this Hamiltonian, right? That's the interpretation.
And you want, so you're...
Well, I want to find, so h here, right? So h is going to be is of the form p squared. I mean, this term here is, it's just a... Let's, I mean, H is going to, yeah.
So not quite sure what it is you're trying to do.
Well, I mean, let's write this equation in Hamiltonian form, right? No? So your equation here, if I take dx squared minus v, this is the equation that will give me, minus v second plus v prime squared, right? So let's say minus mm-hmm. this guy is mm-hmm. your kinetic term. And then there's a potential term, which is, minus v x dx plus d. So, mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because it's not a Hermitic Hamiltonian, but so if I call I dx t and x is q, so this guy is an equation, and then I just have this. So the Hamiltonian is something funky like p square plus I d x p, which is kind of a residual operator, and then
D times
V. Oh, now it's V, so it's not an infinite.
Oh, shit.
Oh, it's unknown. No, so it's not an infinite. I can't write it as an infinite. Okay. Now, this term, okay, the other term is not an infinite. Okay, so then I'm wrong. Not an Hamiltonian equation. Is it, well, maybe I can take log of, yeah, I mean, okay, V. But the original equation was somehow Hamiltonian. So it isn't. So here you write the term. Okay, so it cannot be Hamiltonian, because otherwise it cannot be a normalization. But now you see, I don't know.
Yeah, that's true. What? That's true. That's
true. I'm just trying to understand the feeling. What is the
I mean, you know, the structure of the equation is v double prime minus v prime squared. This is coming from demanding that the partition function is invariant under the flow. You know, this form that I was talking about yesterday. So we've got something like. You know, this generic form for the flow equation. This is why you're getting that two-term structure.
Then the dV is the.
That's just coming from rescalings. So that d was coming when you rescaled the momentum, and the d was picked up from the momentum conserving delta function.
Okay.
So.
We have this classical interpretation, or is it a bit obscured by the fact that having rescaled everything, each part has disappeared by construction, so maybe it's not that obvious to see what is really classical in here.
Well, it's the number of derivatives. Right? Each part is in the number of derivatives. So this is only something in each part. I mean, it's the number of derivatives. Yeah, I agree.
Well, if that's the case, then your classical bit would be just the.
Well, I'm not looking for the classical bit. I'm looking for the.
So is the, I just want to check if the strategy for making this plot is clear. What's going on there? Is it apparent what the strategy is?
So here, no, I don't know.
So this plot, you've got your equation. You've chosen one of your boundary conditions, V prime is equal to zero. Mm-hmm. Your other boundary condition is you just choose some value for this.
Yeah.
So you choose some value, and you numerically iterate your flow equation. You numerically iterate your equation, and generically you encounter a singularity at some value of the field x, and you just plot that value. So I reach the value of the singularity here for this value, so I plot a point there. And this peak here corresponds to a globally well-defined solution, because at no value of the field do I encounter a singularity, so the plot goes off up to infinity here. So any peak here is globally well-defined, and I'm only interested. Sorry? Yeah, or as far as you can numerically iterate, which is not infinity, but you know, in principle. So
sorry, V was what?
So V is the thing that
it's something that's your momentum.
Something which is what?
Is the potential,
yes,
it's
the
for the 2.5?
No, so V is the V potential. Yeah.
In terms of V of X now.
Yeah, so you're looking at the momentum independent part.
Yeah.
So
the potential.
So what you're doing is you're basically scanning here through.
So you're scanning the normalization of the constant field configurations.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the local potential.
So that is U phi is sum over n V n phi to the term with no derivative.
Mm-hmm.
What does it mean about this mineral?
And you find that there's only for a finite number of constant values of this field, of this potential that
yeah, so there's only
that you can find the fixed point.
So in D equals
because
4,
for generic phi of these, you won't be able to find the fixed point because you will
hit a singularity, exactly. Yeah.
So there's only a finite choices which you would be able to really find the fixed point all the way to infinity.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yep.
But do you really hit a singularity, or it's just that in fact you will have a V phi, this V phi diverge when phi approach phi c.
Yeah, so exactly. So it's diverging at some finite value of the field.
It's diverging at some finite value, but it means the potential is a singular, but it's a very confined potential, so the field cannot be big.
Right.
Which then makes it trivially normalizable, because if you have a potential that forces the field to be a finite.
Well.
It's like having a potential which is an infinite way.
Sure, yeah. I think these are the precise things you want to be discarding. You really want solutions which are well defined for all values of phi, all values of the field.
Why physically?
That's a good question, actually.
Probably have a physical system which is sitting at infinite way, which prevents.
And with a quantum field theory, could you do that and end up with a well-defined quantum field theory? I'm not sure you could.
Why not? I would say it's even easier to define a quantum theory if you really imagine. Take of x squared, take inverse hyperbolic Cauchy.
What we're looking for, we're looking for a fixed point solution in the first instance, and then in the second instance, the field phi is like a dummy parameter in some ways. What we want to write the action as is some form like this, where let's say you've got ui, and the phi is just providing some basis which we can expand s in terms of. So these are the things which are flowing. The phi is just providing our basis. So I'd have thought that you really need this to be defined for all values of phi.
I'm just saying,
I mean, the flow shouldn't be depending on any specific configuration of the field. The configuration of the fields are just, as I said, they're just providing this basis. So I think you want it well defined.
You can imagine actions where in some sense the action becomes infinite, if phi is a good algebra. And like an inverse Cauchy potential.
Yeah.
Maybe you don't know that physically. It's a pure potential, so it will force the field to the theory to sit at the bottom more strongly than the square.
Yeah. No, well, my feeling is that it really wouldn't make sense in this context. But, But anyhow, this is the strategy that one is using, and so for any actions which aren't well defined at some critical value of the field, you're not.
Maybe it doesn't make sense because 5 here is your escape field. So, this was the original field, I guess you were able to. Now it's your escape field, so you want to send this field to.
So why do you think it makes a difference that you've done the rescaling?
Well, because I can have a potential which is like that, and then, you know, I can have a potential which is like that, and give me a zero probability to be outside a certain range.
But what's the potential outside of that? I mean, I'm integrating overall.
So I'm saying that this guy contains a cutoff that says that phi, you know, should be smaller than lambda, because otherwise the exponential minus s is like the weight is zero.
Unitarian well-behaved theory, right. Is omnipotential, where now phi, the value of phi is limited, right? It's bounded, so.
I mean, take it as a limit of a guy like that, where you grow the a to the potential hugely, and then. As long as you're exploring these values.
I don't know, I'm thinking in the sense of when you're.
I mean, usually you don't. I think. You don't do that.
No.
But. What you do is that in an action, if the action becomes infinite, it means the probability to go there is zero. So it's just a forbidden region at the quantum level. But maybe the fact that you're risking doesn't matter, right? Because the rescale field is not the neural field, so maybe you want to send the lambda to zero, and you know, in the limit you want to. The idea of the way you measure is not correlation functions. What is physical is not the correlation function of the rescale field, right?
Right. Well, I mean, no. I mean, the field is playing the role of a dummy parameter. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, you don't produce any formulae which explicitly involve the field.
No, but the potential. Well, I mean, okay, you don't want this potential. I'm not sure. I mean, with that, you know, if you have such a potential, the passing level is much. It's much easier to define.
Right.
Because it's much more convergent.
Well, maybe we come back to this afterwards, but at any rate, these potentials are thrown away, which I think is probably fair enough. So in D equals 3, the situation's a little bit different. You get two of these spikes here. So this one corresponds to the Gaussian fixed point. Again, this is globally well-defined. And the other globally well-defined solution is this non-trivial fixed point, which corresponds to the Wilson-Fisher fixed point. So there's a way of sort of understanding this now in terms of some alternative boundary conditions. And if we look at the fixed point equation here, then for globally non-singular solutions, the large x behavior just has to go as x squared. And you can just take this by plugging this in directly. And you can see that will solve it. So we've got an x squared here and an x squared coming there. Now, the point is that if I impose this as a pair of boundary conditions for both x goes to plus and minus infinity, then I've now got two conditions for a second-order differential equation, and this leads to a discrete set of acceptable fixed-point solutions. So this is the alternative way of looking at it.
Sorry, for the solution, what happens to these relative terms? So one is constant, which one is dominating?
So this term, for large x, this term and this term are the ones that are dominating.
So the quantum part disappears. So the classical solution is your fixed.
Sorry, yes, and this point. Yes, exactly that. The quantum terms are disappearing. Yeah. So you find what the large field behavior of the equation is. So you can deduce what the large field behavior is if it's well defined there. And because you know that you want it to be well defined for large field, you impose that the solution has to look like this asymptotically. because the other option is that it blows up at some finite value which you don't want. So was there a question about this?
So the logic is classical. Is there an intuitive reason for that?
So is there a reason for what?
Why the logic behavior is always the classical behavior? Is it true for all fixed points, or it's only true for the
motion? No, this is true for all fixed points, and I think this... this is probably a mean field argument, I'd expect. If you've got a very, very, very big value of the field, then the fluctuations about this would be small compared to it. If you take the field to be arbitrarily large, so you just get a mean field-like evolution.
Sorry, no, I don't understand. It's not the classical part. No, it's not. No. The classical part is storing the first two terms, but then.
So this is the quantum term here, which is not contributing in this limit.
Because of V prime squared, no, you call it classical, okay. So if you drop this V second term, then you're saying that's the solution, that's the larger solution. Right? Is that the claim?
The claim is that, this term is subleading for large x, and then this solves what's left, approximately, in the limit. Talking about which terms you throw away is, I'm not sure that there is any easy intuition behind it, because the form of the equation is very different, actually, in the case where you use the Wetterich equation. In that case, where, in fact, I'll come to it shortly, there it's much clearer what you throw away. In fact, in the Wetterich case, the whole of the right-hand side of the flow equation just goes, and you're just left with the left-hand side, which was just the rescalings. Whereas with this form, it's a little bit more involved.
But that's what you say, it's the classical part.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. So, what has the LPA, the local potential approximation, actually done for us?
No. Maybe because here you need the solution, but I'm trying to change it.
Or the direction becomes because these are for me and all the way down the arrow.
So what the LPA actually does, this is a quote from Tim Morris's paper, is it allows for an exhaustive search of continuum limits in the entire infinite dimensional space of potentials V of X. So this is really a quite powerful thing to be able to do. And I think it's something unique within the exact RG. And you can perform these searches at higher orders in the derivative expansion. I think that such searches have been performed at second order in the derivative expansion. Beyond that, I think the equations become too unwieldy to deal with.
Also, can you comment? There's always a statement that even there's a universal feature, it seems, in the derivative expansion, that if you take a non-convex potential, then the normalization group will always convexify this potential.
Right.
Can you explain a bit more that?
Convexification of the potential.
Under the flow, right?
So it's sorry.
Under the flow.
So under the flow. So it's only.
So what you start with is a potential.
It only.
It's a Mexican hat. It's like saying that the Gavin constant corresponding to the squared one will dominate under the flow.
Well, the potential.
Like if you have a potential which has Mexican hat and non-convex, you go back to.
In the limit that you integrate everything out, yes.
So in the limit when you
an intermediate
you cannot have a symmetry breaking potential.
Well, when you've at intermediate stages, as if you have a non-zero lambda, then the potential can be non-convex. Yeah. But if once you've integrated everything out, it will be convex.
So is it easy to see it from your equation?
I don't know, to be honest. But I do know where to look it up. So the review that I mentioned by Wetterich at the start has a long section on the convexity of the effective action.
Because it's some statement about the unicity of the vacuum state.
It forces identity issue and uniqueness.
Oh, well, I said that's the place to look it up. Sure. Well, I said it's discussed in detail in Vesterich's paper, so I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, but that's where to look it up. So once one's found a fixed point, the thing you do is linearize about it and classify the operators. So here's the local potential approximation flow equation again, where I've now kept this bit. And so away from a fixed point, you just write the action as the fixed point action plus some perturbation. And if I treat V as small, then I can linearize. And of course, the only term where this really makes a difference is this nonlinear term here. So I've now got this linear second order partial differential equation. I can separate variables as follows. So this contains the t dependence here. Alpha is just some constant. And this contains the details of the field dependence. And so I get this equation. So you can see that the lambda has been pulled down by the v dot here. And there's a note that will be important in a minute, that any finite distance away from the fixed point, you can't necessarily trust the linear approximation, because if my field is big enough, then it doesn't matter how small I try to make this, it will get bigger and bigger for large field values. So this gives another apparent paradox. So here's the equation again. So it's second order. Again, I've got a two-parameter continuum of solutions as before. So one corresponds to the normalization of the field, so fine. But what about the other one? And the problem is that unlike the other case where I had a nonlinear equation, I could argue that the solutions became non-singular, became singular. This equation is actually linear, so all solutions are globally well-defined.
So this equation is the one...
This is for the eigenvalues, so I've linearized the equation. So I've taken this equation and I've linearized and separated.
Then the V dot has disappeared.
Right, so I've linearized and then separated variables.
Mm-hmm. So you're looking at your fixed point and you're looking at how many fixed points I have around.
Not how many fixed points, I'm looking at the directions out of it, so I want to find if the directions are stable or unstable. So I'm just doing a stability analysis of the fixed point.
And you just proved there's only one guy.
Right, well, no, I proved that there's a discrete number of fixed points. Now suppose that I've found one of those fixed points, I now want to find whether the directions out of the fixed point are stable or unstable. So I just linearize about it. That's all I'm doing.
But you need to know the second order to see if it's stable or unstable, right?
Well, that depends. So that's for marginal. No, that's for marginal terms. So for most terms, you can determine at first order whether they're relevant or irrelevant. It's only if you can't determine at that order that you have to go to second order to determine this. And that's where the term marginal comes from. So the resolution to this problem is subtle, and I'm going to put it to the side for 1 minute and actually look at a specific example of how to use this equation. So suppose we look at the Gaussian fixed point where we can actually calculate things. So after linearization and separation of variables, I've got this form for the solution. So this is the fixed point action, and this is the perturbation. And this was the equation that I just wrote down that u of x must satisfy. Now, things simplify at the Gaussian fixed point because v star is just equal to zero. And so my equation can be written in this form. And now if I shift x goes to x over root d, this thing actually transforms into the Hermite equation. So I've just written this down here. And I'll just put up Hermite's equation on the next transparency for comparison. So the Hermite equation is written in this form, so u prime double prime minus 2xu prime plus 2n, where n is an integer, u equals 0. And it's known that this has polynomial solutions. So for n integer, these are the solutions, these are the Hermite polynomials. And if we compare this equation with this equation, then you can see that this n can be identified with this guy here, and so we must have quantization of lambda, because n is an integer, so this quantity here must be an integer. So for an even potential, I'm going to say n is 2k, and I can just solve for lambda. So I've got that...
I mean, you're looking for solutions which are regular at x equal to 0 or something like that. Otherwise, you could
solve. Right, so I'll come to that in a second, yeah. Yeah, sorry, so... So I'm equating 2k with this thing here, and I get a solution for lambda k, and I find that my eigenvalues are quantized, and I've got a polynomial potential. So I can now see which my relevant and irrelevant operators are. So I just want to just recall the setup. So this was the form I was writing. So this is the perturbation. This is the form it takes after I've separated variables. Lambda of k takes this form. Directions with lambda greater than zero are relevant because they grow as t grows. The ones with lambda less than zero are irrelevant because they shrink as t grows. And the ones with lambda equals zero are marginal, the ones you need to go beyond linear order to decide whether they're relevant or irrelevant. So in d equals 4, this equation here just becomes 4 minus 2k. You find that the only relevant direction, the only thing with lambda greater than 0, is when k equals 1, then you've got lambda equals 2. That's the mass term. The marginal direction is the lambda phi to the 4 term, and everything else is irrelevant. So you can see that this is giving the correct classification. And in d equals 3, this equation here now just becomes lambda equals lambda, ooh, that should be a k, is equal 3 minus k. Now you've got two relevant directions. K equals 1 is obviously positive. K equals 2 is positive. This is the phi to the 4 term. You've got one marginal direction, and everything else is irrelevant. So this is picking up this procedure. This local potential approximation is correctly classifying the eigenvalues for the three-dimensional and four-dimensional cases. So where's the problem? So we've looked at the solution to this equation, and we found that we've got this quantization of the eigenvalues. Whereas the initial paradox seemed to be that we were going to get this one parameter continuous family of eigenvalues. But we've actually done a specific calculation and found that the problem doesn't seem to exist. So what we did is we linearized the flow equation separated variables, found polynomial solutions, and for these polynomial solutions, the eigenvalues were quantized. And the point, as Lauren was alluding to, is that there are non-polynomial solutions to this equation. And for large x, you can just, by substitution, check that this solves it. And there's also no quantization of lambda. So what on earth is actually going on here? Because it seems that, you know, this is just the Gaussian fixed point that one is looking at, and suddenly you've got this spectrum, you know, of continuous eigenvalues, many of which are actually relevant. And this is the Gaussian fixed point. So the solution comes back to...
Did you get small x
in my similarity? No, the solution's subtler than that.
Yeah, no, okay, small x because they go like x to some non-integer power.
I'd have to look up the small x dependence. But there's no pathology in that sense. The resolution to the problem is different to that. And it comes
x
back...
Is x positive? I
mean, no, not necessarily. Sorry?
The solution we have to cut.
There's nothing like that where the solution is, I don't think, is ill-defined. The,
it does a cut.
The point, sorry, where does it have a cut?
No.
C is
a constant?
C is just a constant, yeah. Yeah, C is just some number. I mean, I don't know off the top of my head what this looks like for small x, but the problem with it is something else. The problem is that you can't build renormalized trajectories out of it, which I'll show in a second. So this comes back to self-similarity. So one of the things I mentioned at the first lecture when I was recalling points of importance was that the trajectories one are really interested in these self-similar ones where you can write the action in this form. Oops. So this was where all lambda dependence occurs through the couplings and the anomalous dimension. And it's only solutions of this type which are of importance for continuum physics. And the point is that you can't use these new directions to construct renormalized trajectories. So, I didn't need to write it down. So renormalized trajectories exhibit this. And it turns out that only solutions which are bounded by polynomials could be used to construct self-similar trajectories. And consequently, these are the only solutions which can be associated with renormalized trajectories. So polynomial boundary conditions, so demanding polynomial boundary conditions for x tends to plus or minus infinity, this now gives us the two boundary conditions we require. And it leads to a quantization of lambda. Yep, so we've got u of x are the solutions to this 2L linearized equation, and there are solutions which are bounded by polynomials and solutions which aren't bounded by polynomials. For reasons that I'll discuss, it turns out that only the ones which are bounded by polynomials can be used to construct self-similar trajectories. And it's only self-similar trajectories that are of importance to continuum physics.
Would you call it a self-similar trajectory?
Is one that can be written in this form. So there's no explicit dependence, let's say, on you know, lambda over lambda zero doesn't appear in here explicitly. All the lambda dependence is appearing through the renormalized couplings. And it turns out that these non-polynomial potentials can't be, non-polynomial solutions can't be written in that form. So the ones that aren't bounded are irrelevant to continuum physics. And as a health warning, there's this paper by Halpin and Huang where these directions were actually discovered, and they incorrectly concluded that there are non-trivial renormalized trajectories for the Gaussian fixed point in D equals 4. And there's actually some misinterpretations of their results as late as 2005 that I was able to find in the phenomenology literature.
Which means that they were interpreting these trajectories as physical?
Yeah, so they found these directions.
And they say they could forget about the self-similarity. These trajectories are good.
Yes, well, they didn't appreciate the importance of self-similarity in this regard, which I'll just show in a second. So if we look at the large field behavior, what we want is we want to determine perturbations which can be identified with renormalized couplings. If we can't identify them with renormalized couplings, we're not interested in them because we're interested in renormalizable theories. And what we need to do is we need to analyze the evolution of trajectories of finite distance from the fixed point. So we've got some fixed point, and we really want to look at what's happening along this flow. And if some finite distance along this flow, we can identify things with renormalized couplings, then we're happy, and if we can't, then we're not. And one point that we make is because we're interested in large field behavior, we're a finite distance away, the linearization is no longer valid because we can always make the so-called small term as big as we like if we look at large enough field values. So I'm writing, I've got, oops.
You're in your linearization region, so where do you want to
go? So my linearization is this. V is equal to V star plus V of X and T, where I'm assuming that little v is small. Mm-hmm. But if I'm some finite distance away from the fixed point, mm-hmm. for large enough field values, little v can become arbitrarily big, so the linearization isn't valid.
Yeah, so you don't want to get out of that.
Hmm?
You don't want to get out
of that. So what I'm saying is if you can't linearize, you need to do something else. So the conclusions you draw from linearizing won't be valid. Mm-hmm. But you can actually solve the equation exactly in the large field limit. And this is easiest to see in Vetterix formalism. So here the flow equation takes this form. So this is the left-hand side of the flow equation, which just involves the field rescalings. And this is the right-hand side. And for large x, you can see that because this is in the denominator, this is just going to vanish. And the solution takes the following form. So if it's useful, I can just quickly show that.
It can be a constant, no?
V of x, T.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm looking for T-dependent solutions. I'm looking for non-trivial solutions of this equation. So it's just a linear partial differential equation.
V vanishes, V grows. You're assuming that V goes to infinity.
Right.
Well, isn't it a statement on
well,
so I mean, maybe that's a statement.
Well, because like, isn't it a statement
on
being
bounded? It goes like that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you want it to be bounded.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe it grows like that.
It's a potential which is, take a cosine potential.
Well,
it's a property of your solution.
Yes, yeah, certainly the case that we're looking at here is that there's two types of solution. They're either bounded by polynomials or bounded by exponentials.
But they're
always growing.
It's not like there's a decaying order.
Not that I'm aware of, no. They're always growing solutions. Well, the solutions of the equation, there are two solutions.
Yes.
So there are ones which grow polynomially, and there are the ones that grow exponentially.
So they both grow?
Mm. So one was of the form,
yeah. Okay, they both grow.
You know, one was the form e to the x squared, and the other one was just x to the n. X to, or what I called X to the 2K.
When they are not polynomial, I'm saying.
Then they grow like this.
So both of them, there's no minus. Both of them grow like exponential.
But yeah, they grow. So the solutions which Halpern and Huang found are exponentially growing in the large X limit. Okay. So this is the solution to the left-hand side. So if I write the potential just as the fixed point potential plus some deviation from it, this statement is just true. This is just a rewriting, and it's true even if V is big. Then what I can do is I can identify this thing here with this form. So if it's useful for me to actually plug this in and check that it's zero, I can do it. If not, I can just carry on. So I'll discuss this form here. So this is the point. So if we consider polynomial perturbations, let's just try this thing going as the argument of some power p. Then you can see that the t-dependent bits can just be combined. So I've got an e to the dt, and I've got an e to the minus dtp. So that's here, and then I've just got an x to the p. And this is self-similar evolution. So I can write this as some coupling, which I'll identify as this bit, times the field. And in fact, if I choose p as follows, I can identify the coupling consistently with a linearized theory. So by making this choice here, this just becomes alpha e to the lambda t, x to some power, just as before. And I'm just identifying g with the thing in front, so everything's fitting together here. So I've got self-similar evolution. For the non-polynomial perturbations, well, self-similar evolution just isn't possible. There's no way that I can write this in this form where I'm separating out the t dependence into some coupling and the field dependence. I just cannot write this in self-similar form. So this is the first problem with it. The second problem is, as you can see pretty much immediately, that the trajectory doesn't actually even sink back into the fixed point for t tends to minus infinity, so you can't use this to construct some flow out of the trajectory. And something else which was shown was, in fact, if you look at how these solutions evolve for large x, you can actually then just decompose them into the normal polynomial ones anyway. So they really can't be used to construct continuum physics. Right, so if I've got time, I'll quickly talk about beyond leading order, which, well, there's not a huge amount that I'm going to say on this, so I'll be quick. So the basic structure is we've just added in this field-dependent term by the kinetic piece here. So it yields a pair of second-order coupled equations for V and K. And the kinetic term is now renormalizing because this thing can flow, and so we have to include an anomalous dimension. As before, the form of the equations depends on the choice of exact RG, and unlike the local potential approximation, it's no longer possible to completely remove the dependence on the cutoff functions, so you get non-universalities explicitly appearing here. So the boundary conditions, so the equations have this following generic form. So this is the left-hand side of the equation for V, this is the left-hand side of the equation for K, and then this involves all the classical terms, the quantum terms, and of course they're coupled together in a nonlinear fashion.
Are you sure that K is always positive?
You mean K of zero? So that you have a right, you want to check the kinetic terms of the correct sign, I presume.
Yeah.
You have to solve the equation and see what the solutions are, I suppose. I don't know if there's any way of telling beforehand. So this is just now the full scaling dimension, so I've incorporated the anomalous dimension. And for the Legendre transformed version, the right-hand sides are subleading for large field.
Do you have an equation for gamma? So how do you determine gamma?
Right, that's exactly what I'm going to talk about. So again, you can look at what the large X behavior is, and you find that V goes as X in this form. It doesn't really matter what the precise form is, but this is the solution. And if we demand this behavior for X goes plus or minus infinity, so we're demanding globally non-singular solutions, and this gives us four conditions. So we've got four conditions for our pair of equations. But now we've got the problem of how does gamma star get determined? So this is the fixed point value of the anomalous dimension. And this comes down to reparameterization invariance. So forgetting about the ERG, just think about a normal partition function. You know that physics doesn't depend on the normalization of the field. You can send phi goes to omega phi whilst leaving the source bit alone, and you get the same physical answers. And more generally, you can do some local change of variables like this, and physics should be invariant. Completely analogously to this, the exact renormalization group equation itself has a reparameterization invariance.
What do you mean by reparameterization
in the RG? Well, I can actually explicitly show you in a transparency or two, so let me. So the point is that fixed point solutions are not unique. And each fixed point belongs to a line of equivalent fixed points. So these, it's not that you've got a line of physically different fixed points. It's just each time you're parameterizing them slightly differently. So you're performing some change of variables, which maps the fixed point into something which has exactly the same physical properties, exactly the same spectrum of eigenvalues, but a different functional form.
So parameterization
just means field definition. Point-wise field definition. So that structure there.
Yes, it's, yeah, field redefinition, yeah.
In local, if you do local extension, then in general, you can.
No, I think you want to keep it local.
Because you're doing local extension, but you were so in the full time.
Well.
Yeah, you can do any change of variable.
Just well, true, I suppose. I mean,
phi is a dummy variable.
Yes.
So any change of variable is good.
As long as it doesn't introduce any pathologies.
Yeah. I mean, any irregular is changeable.
So.
Your action is non-local anyway. So.
Well. So anyway, I've mentioned that point. And these redundant operators, which I alluded to at the beginning of the talk, they arise because of this symmetry. So these are, you can think of these as one thing that they do is they're going to take you, the redundant direction can take you along this line of equivalent fixed points. So they don't affect the physics in any way. They're just taking you in unphysical directions which are related to reparameterizations. And so this allows the determination of the anomalous dimension because you've got four boundary conditions plus reparameterization invariance, which gives you a fifth boundary condition, essentially. So you could do this explicitly. You could, for example, well, so you can either use the reparameterization invariance or you could use it to choose, for example, the normalization of the kinetic term.
These trajectories are infinite.
Yes, well, in fact, I think the next one, I'll actually show you a specific example of what they look like. And this is discussed in Wegener's review. And there's a very nice way of thinking about how gamma is determined. He says that reparameterization invariance turns the exact RG equation at a fixed point into a nonlinear eigenvalue equation for the anomalous dimension. So here's an actual example. So here's my exact RG equation, where I'm just going to take the simplest seed action. And I'm going to look for critical Gaussian fixed point solutions of the following form. So this is just the normal kinetic piece, which is always there. And I'm going to take this as an ansatz for the extra term. So this is just, again, it's a quadratic in the fields. And I'm going to write it, I'm going to take a guess that it's p squared times some z of p squared. And I'm just going to solve for z. I'm just going to substitute this into here and see what I get. And at the Gaussian fixed point, gamma is zero. So I can substitute this in, I can solve, I get this equation for z. I can plug the solution back into here, and I get this form for the general action. So this hopefully goes somewhere to answering your question. So what this is here is this is a line of equivalent fixed points parameterized by A.
Where is
A is just any constant which has to be greater than 1 so that this is well-defined. So if CUV is a monotonically decreasing function, it can never exceed 1. So you just want A to be some constant that's bigger than 1. And then this will have the right sign, and it will be well-defined for all CUV. So you can see that as you change A, this is going to amount to some quite complicated momentum-dependent field redefinition. Yeah. And that's the problem for the derivative expansion. So this is the general Gaussian solution. And a derivative expansion will break reparameterization invariance for most cutoffs. So, as I said, to map from one solution to another one with a change of variables, it's momentum dependent, but the derivative expansion is an expansion in momentum. So you're generally speaking going to break this invariance. There are two exceptions. You can use a sharp cutoff, But then you have to replace the derivative expansion with momentum scale expansion. You can't just do a derivative expansion with a sharp cutoff. Or the Vettori formalism, where you use a very particular type of cutoff function. But unfortunately, in both cases, the derivative expansion isn't actually convergent. So there's this tension here between, on the one hand, having reparameterization invariance maintained, and on the other hand, having convergence of your derivative expansion. So finally, I can conclude. So just to outline the pros and the cons of the derivative expansion. So the pros are it's intrinsically non-perturbative. It permits this search over an infinite dimensional space of solutions, which involve completely arbitrary potentials. And the identification of non-trivial fixed points, in practical cases, seems to be robust. And if you actually compute critical exponents, it's got, generally at worst, decent accuracy of a border about 33% error, and sometimes excellent accuracy, you know, up to fractions of a percent. And for an example of how well you can do this, there's this paper by Tim Morris where he looks at a two-dimensional scalar field theory and calculates or identifies, I forget now, 10, 20 fixed points and calculates about 100 quantities associated with them and compares them with the values from conformal field theory. And at worst, they agree to a precision of about 30%, and at best, as I said, the agreement's excellent. And the real con is that there's this, what I would say, uneasy tension between reparameterization invariance on the one hand, which you need if you want to get a unique value of the anomalous dimension, but also convergence of the approximation scheme you're using. So, thanks.
It is reparameterization invariance. Does it mean, is it that when I look for the fixed point, you give some boundary conditions, but for instance, the parameterization of the wave function can be whatever?
Well, actually, so that's one example. Yes, so one example of reparameterization invariance is that you can choose. Yes, you can choose the normalization of the field to be anything that you want. So that's one example of it, but it's not the only example.
And then, if you do it with this derivative expansion, you lose this. So this statement on the tension means that somehow you lose this.
Absolutely. Yeah. So
if you care for convergence, so some choices of the Z, for instance, of the normalization of the wave function will lead you to converge entire derivative expansion.
Well, so the statement would be that I'm going to choose some setup for the exact RG and. Yeah, on the one hand, there's convergence, and on the other hand, there's reparameterization invariance. Now, the way that the anomalous dimension at the fixed point was determined, it was determined by my four boundary conditions plus reparameterization invariance. Let me just finish. So if I break reparameterization invariance, then the value of the anomalous dimension at the fixed point will be different if I change my setup. So I won't get a universal value for it.
Okay.
So, or to put it another way,
what is the convergence
entry? Well, so the convergence is a separate issue. As I said, there's the two things. Well, you want to do two things, ideally. You want to have reparameterization on the one hand, reparameterization invariance on the one hand, and you want to have convergence on the other. Unfortunately, they're mutually exclusive. So if you take a form of the exact RG that does have reparameterization invariance, then if you went to sufficiently high order in a derivative expansion, it doesn't mean that the results at low order aren't good.
but somehow it means that these are directions which are irrelevant in the real sense.
Yes.
The direction, let's say, in the normalization of the wave function, in the low orders, they start to become. If I try to visualize this pictorially, I have this trajectory in Z,
yes.
Let's say, and then I can start. And I have, along this trajectory in Z, there are no fixed points. Because
yes.
This is the generous.
Yes.
But now, if I start moving along the flow, there's only some points where I can actually obtain a convergence series.
Some points. I think the way to look at it slightly differently. So, so if you have reparameterization invariance, then what you've got here is a line. Of equivalent fixed points. If you break reparameterization, then you've got a line of inequivalent fixed points. So, for example,
and then everything converges.
Well, it's so I'm sure. Well, it, yes, yes, in Well, actually, okay, so let's be more specific. So you could find exact RGs which have neither reparameterization invariance nor convergence, if you wanted to. Right, nothing to stop you writing down one of those. But it would be questionable as to why you'd want to do it. But you know how I said you could use reparameterization invariance, for example, you could trade this as not choosing the normalization of the kinetic term. So what that would mean if you break reparameterization invariance is that for each different value of the kinetic term, the normalization of the kinetic term, you get a different value for the anomalous dimension. So, you know, there are some people have schemes where they try to decide on some optimization criteria, you know, some principle of minimum sensitivity or whatever. But, yeah, I'd say it's a really unfortunate drawback that you have this.
So apart from this potential calculation, there are other examples of infinite scanning?
Well, I said it's been done beyond leading order, so this is where you've got your scanning through both V and K, so where you've got momentum-dependent terms in the action.
And in the other systems, then it's scarcity?
Well, okay, so in a very limited sense, so I think there's a case in U1, a non-compact U1 gauge theory in three dimensions, where general actions of this form were taken. So these were actions which depended, I think, on F mu nu, but had no derivatives there. So I think that's been done. Mm-hmm. But the trouble is that if you were to try to do that in QCD, so it all boils down to the number of invariants, I think, that you can construct. And I think in QCD, if you try to do a similar thing, it's something like you'd get 34 coupled equations at first order.
What about the other...
intractable.
Another extreme would be not to look at the local expansion, but the most non-local. So here you look at, there is the term which are from quadratic in the field,
yep.
But arbitrary I in the limit.
Yes.
And this one contains even, you know, if you do that, sure. It contains even, in fact, much more physics because it contains the whole spectra of the theory. So, Can you run an equation for this guy? The quadratic part.
Sorry, the p squared. Okay, so.
So
you want to look at the d mu phi squared term, is that what you're saying?
No. I want to look at phi, a function of box phi.
Much more. You know, the guy that knows about the spectra, all the.
Yeah.
You know, if I was doing that for QCD, this is the guy that contains information about mm-hmm. all the blue balls.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So this is the guy where you would look for confinement. Phi, I from box, phi. That's
okay, right.
I mean, this one is much more, you know, contains the information about the whole spectra of the
field. Yep.
So that's the guy with...
I've never seen a flow equation, but I mean...
Can you make it in a closed form?
Well, this is what I'm just wondering. I mean, you'd need to figure out how to project onto that part of the action.
Yeah.
Which?
So, here.
Well, hold on. You'd want more than this. If it's just quadratic, this isn't going to do you any good. And you're just going to get Gaussian solutions.
I'm just going to get Gaussian solutions. Yeah. So.